bits to each other all afternoon. "Ainsley!" came a voice outside the van. They both looked round. "Who's that?"
"No one," said Ainsley, scowling. "Can we shut the doors?"
"Not really," said Nina, going forward.
"Ainsley! Not now, Ben!"
yelled back Ainsley suddenly, louder than Nina had expected.
"I'm busy. Go away."
Nina hurried down the steps. Standing at the bottom was possibly the dirtiest little boy she'd ever seen. His hair had obviously been cut with kitchen scissors. His cheeks were sticky, his fingernails black.
"Hello," Nina said.
The child, who looked to be around 8, scowled back at her.
"Ainsley, I want breakfast."
Ainsley came out, scowling.
"I told you not to come here."
"There's no breakfast. I left some custard creams in the side cupboard. I ate them yesterday."
"Well, that's your fault, isn't it?"
The boy screwed up his face as if he was going to cry.
"Is this your brother?"
said Nina, not wanting to sound nosy or interfering. Ainsley had started coming in mornings before school, and Nina had started to pay her a small wage.
"Aye," said Ainsley.
She reluctantly took out the wages Nina had given her the day before.
"Can I go to the baker's?"
"Aye, but Binny come back."
Nina didn't say anything, in case what she said was wrong, but she didn't like the look of this at all.
"Where's your mum?"
she said gently. Ben looked at her rudely.
"Shut up,"
he said, and snatched the money out of Ainsley's hand. Ainsley turned back to unpacking the books, her face closed up and inscrutable, daring Nina to say something. So Nina didn't, and instead concentrated on serving one of her regulars, who only read books that took place in a post-apocalyptic universe. He didn't care if it was zombies, flu, or a nuclear bomb that had taken everyone out. He only cared that there was almost nobody left to get in the way. Nina let her eyes stray out of the van. The boy was still loitering in the square. They were back in Kirinfief, where Ainsley lived, chowing down on a sausage roll and staring at them. She smiled encouragingly. When the customer left, she went back to helping Ainsley with the beautiful golden editions of Up on the Rooftops. Suddenly, he was there again, looking over Ainsley's shoulder.
"What's that?" "Go away,"
hissed Ainsley.
"I told you not to come here."
"You can come here," said Nina,
even as Ainsley shot her a look.
"Looks boring,"
said Ben. He was still staring at the cover, though. The three children, and Robert Carrier, the pigeon, in his top hat, silhouetted against the dome of St. Paul's Cathedral.
"Off to Galleon's Reach, to meet the Queen of the Nethers,"
said Ainsley dreamily.
"Oh, how I would love to be reading this for the first time."
Nina nodded emphatically.
"Every time I stopped reading it, I couldn't believe I couldn't fly."
Ainsley nodded.
"You're going to have a whole village full of kids who haven't read it."
"Everyone still reads it, don't they?"
said Nina.
"Otherwise, how do they know what it's like to fly?"
"No one can fly,"
said Ben scornfully. He'd now taken out a packet of crisps and was eating them messily, crumbs falling onto the floor of the van. Ainsley scowled at him.
"They can in this book," she said. "That's what you don't understand about reading, idiot."
"What? That is a bunch of made-up stuff."
"You can look at it if you like,"
said Nina, although she was nervous of his sticky fingers. These books were valuable. Ben shrugged and turned his face away.
"Sounds rubbish."
"Well, it doesn't matter to you, does it? He won't go to school,"
said Ainsley.
"Can't you make him?" said Nina.
"Or your mum?"
"Ha! He won't listen to us." "Readings for babies,"
burst out Ben suddenly, his ears bright red.
"It's stupid. I don't care."
And he suddenly hurled his crisp packet on the floor and disappeared out of the van, running across the square. Ainsley sighed and shrugged.
"That's all he does," she said. "I can't help."
Nina looked after him.
"But can't the school help? That's not right."
"They've washed their hands of him," said Ainsley. "He won't go. My mum doesn't care. The school doesn't care. He's a disruptive influence. She hung her head. This was a long speech for her. And there isn't another school for 5 miles. I don't think anyone cares. Do you want me to ring social services? Ainsley jumped up, her face a picture of dismay.
No, please no. You can't. They'll separate us.
They're very good these days, said Nina, who'd come up against them a lot in the library service. They're really kind and helpful, honestly. Ainsley shook her head, tears gleaming in the corners of her eyes.
Please no, she said. Please, please don't. Please. We're fine, really. We're okay. We're all right.
And she looked so heartbroken, Nina didn't know what to do. Another child came in, nicely dressed and cared for with her mother.
Oh, look, said the mother. I haven't seen this for years. Up on the rooftops. Wow.
Her rather tight face softened suddenly.
I love this book so much. It made me feel like I could fly.
The little girl looked up curiously.
Can I have it? Of course, darling. We'll read it together. I think you're going to love it.
Ainsley's face was stony as Nina took the money, the most she'd ever made in one sale. Chapter 20. The days began to take on a pattern. After Nina had finished work, she would cash up, then start planning what she was going to leave for Marek on their tree. It had developed into a full-blown flirtation. Some days she just wrote to him what was on her mind and he'd write back. She realized that she hadn't written a letter for years and years, actually sat down and committed her thoughts to paper rather than pinging them off in an email. She wrote more slowly, felt more deeply. Always she remembered Marek's big puppy-dog eyes, his sweet concern for her. He wrote to her about things he missed from home, about funny things he'd seen through people's back windows. His English was broken, and his spelling could be hit and miss, but he had a lovely, often curious way of expressing himself, and she understood him perfectly. No matter how much Sarinda told her it wasn't real, that she was living through a fantasy, she couldn't help it. For even with Sarinda there, and the new people she met every day at the van, she still felt rather lonely. Brand new, alone up here in this little green corner at the tip of the world. Daydreaming about Marek was something to keep her warm, a lovely idea she kept in her heart all day long, thinking of things he would like, what would make him laugh, what would make a pretty parcel in a bag. One night it was a little sculpture of a bear she found for pennies in a market, another time a book of woodcut art nobody wanted, a miniature of whiskey she'd been handed as part of a promotion in one of the larger towns, some deep-scented heather. And he would drop off packets of sweeties from his home country, a carved pencil she thought he might have made himself, some new handmade notepaper, which she treasured. And then, one day, as she was wondering to herself, wandering down the lane by the meadow, how on earth it could possibly still be light at 10:30 in the evening, she opened his latest note in his familiar dark hand, written as if the pen was too small for his large paw. Saturday, it said simply. No sleeper. Her heart began to beat faster immediately. What had been delicate, a little courtship played out in an unusual way, had suddenly changed into something far more real. Every night she'd gone to bed thinking about Marek, about his gentle, strange foreign ways, his unflappability, and this unexpected relationship that had somehow sprung up between them. She knew that the railway tree, ailing as it was just as important to him as it was to her. His notes, filled with poetry and the occasional snatches of his own language, felt to her deeply rich and romantic, and she had saved them, every one. Nights when he was not working or there was nothing on the tree were wholly disappointing. Nights when a bag rocked gently in the wind filled her utterly with delight. But now, to meet, to be with one another in person once again, her heart sped up in her chest with excitement. Sarinda, predictably, was unimpressed. What are you going to do, snog on a train? What if you get covered in coal? Nina swallowed hard. Of course not. It'll just be a chance to stop and chat. That's all.
Sarinda snorted.
Oh, come on, Soars. It's been so long.
What about Ferdy? Ferdy doesn't count. Technically Nina's last boyfriend, Ferdy had been a faintly cadaverous poet who'd hung around the library in Birmingham after an event because she was the only person who would listen to him. They'd ended up kind of dating, although he got very upset if he didn't feel she was listening properly to his poetry, which was convincingly awful and squarely of the dead crow, I hate you daddy school. On the other hand, this had made it far easier to break up with him. Nina had simply indicated that she hadn't really understood the metaphors in his most recent work, entitled All Is Black, 17, and he had flown into a rage and declared her a Philistine. She'd heard that after that he'd given up the poetry, cut his hair, and taken a job in a bank in Aston, but she didn't know if that was true.
Well, he's certainly hung around my kitchen for long enough. That's not a real relationship, is it? And Damien, in university? Yes. You told him you were leaving him so that you could take on the world and go out and do lots of different things. Then you sat upstairs in your bedroom reading for the next 8 years. Well, exactly. And now I'm here. And it's all exciting and full of possibilities. You're the one always telling me to get out there and do more. Yes, but not with some guy you met on a train. Why not? People meet each other in all sorts of places. You met the Gus in a barn. Yes, and then we hung out together and got on. You use my luxury pad to screw in. That's hanging out. We don't moon about and leave poetry on treetops and behave like funny little people in a story or teenagers or something. Well, that's what this is about. We're going to spend some time together, get to know one another.
Why doesn't he just come up during daylight hours? Said Sarinda. Nina couldn't answer that.
See? It's because he's as hooked on the entire thing as you are. This little fantasy life you've got going where he sends you pretty flowers, which he can do as long as he likes because it's all in your heads. I'm sure it's fun and everything, but it isn't real, and neither is meeting at midnight in a good shed. It's not a good shed. It's a level crossing. It's romantic.
Sarinda rolled her eyes.
Well, good for you. The Gus is coming round and we're making a takeaway, which would be like getting a takeaway, if there was anywhere to get a takeaway, which there isn't. And watching a movie.
Hang on, have you moved in here, with the Gus?
I'm on holiday, said Sarinda severely, in the same tone of voice she used every morning when the office rang to ask politely if she was considering coming back at any point.
Are you going to find out the first part of his name? Said Nina.
I don't feel it's very important at this juncture.
Okay, we'll try and learn it before you get married.
They were now coming to the very height of summer. Although you still needed a jacket after the sun went down, the fields were ridiculously awash with glory. Wild flowers, ripening crops, waving long grass, soaked during the long winter, and now sprouting profusely in every hedgerow and space it could find. An orgy of blooms and growth everywhere, the entire countryside spilling over. It was how Nina felt herself. That after a long, long winter, she too was ready to emerge, proudly casting off her old clothes, her protective coating of books and high denier tights, and a downcast head. She was nervous to absolute distraction, couldn't help it, and she was cross with Sarinda too. Wasn't she always saying she had to live more, stop burying herself away? Well, here she was, going out, into life, and a big life too, not takeaway and telly. Not listening to someone complain about the lack of opportunity for poets in Birmingham and how misunderstood they were. This was great buckets of flowers, of poetry, real poetry, of, she truly believed, deeply held feelings. She was catching the night train.
Chapter 21. It was, unusually, warm enough for Nina to sit, swinging on a gate, and she did so, enjoying the gentle creak against the other sounds of the wood at night. She felt as if she were in the magic faraway tree, with the forest saying, "Wisha, wisha, wisha." She closed her eyes and wished very hard, a smile playing around her lips, her heart beating nervously in her chest, the countryside alive around her, and when she awoke from what had in reality been half a dream, the lights of the great train, with its groaning axles and heavy trundle, was suddenly there in the distance. Nina's heart sped up as the train slowed down. She checked. Makeup on, matching underwear. The fact that she'd come prepared felt a bit strange. But on the other hand, well, this was a date. A peculiar type of date, but a date nonetheless. It was finally happening. She wasn't just reading about it, she was doing it. She wiped her hands on her skirt. It was a wide 50s-style one, with a belt, and she was wearing a plain top with a cardigan over it. The train slowed even more, cranking gradually further and further down the line, its brakes giving out that odd, sharp smell of asbestos, which she'd never liked, but which now reminded her of the night she and Marek had met. At last, it juddered to a tremendous halt. It sounded like it was exhaling, slowly. Then the night and the air were suddenly very still, and Nina felt adrenaline shoot through her. Her hand strayed to her mouth. The train was very quiet. Nobody came. She had worked out from learning their shift patterns that Jim wouldn't be on the train tonight. It would just be Marek. No sleeper. No timetable, or none they looked at too closely. Just the two of them in the middle of the Highlands, all by themselves. The cab door opened quietly, and Nina took a step forward. Then another. She was breathing heavily now, a mixture of nerves and extreme excitement. Marek didn't emerge, and she had a momentary panic that maybe he wasn't there after all. It was someone else, coming to tell her how dangerous it was to mess about on the railway track. Still, no one. Steeling herself, she slipped through the closed barrier. There was never anyone along at night. Surely there wouldn't be this evening either. That would be the cruelest of luck. But the roads, as ever, were silent. The farmers and the workers finally fast asleep in their well-earned beds. She moved towards the engine, the enormously long train snaking behind it. She kept her focus on little steps. And then she was there, looking up. Marek was leaning against the cab door. His hooded black eyes were slightly tentative, his curly hair wild as usual. When he saw her, he broke into a wide smile. "I'm not sure you would come," he said, blinking. He still looked amazed to see her standing there, as if she'd appeared from a dream.
"You invited me," said Nina.
"I did, yes."
They looked at each other for 1 second more. Then, in the stillness of the great night, Marek carefully, slowly put his hand out to help her up, and Nina took it. In the tiny space of the cab, neither of them knew quite what to do or say.
I have picnic, said Marek, blinking heavily.
Nina smiled. She hadn't brought anything tonight, knowing she would see him after all.
That sounds lovely, she said. Do we have time?
Marek shrugged.
I think she will be fine.
He patted the console fondly.
You will be fine. I have informed control of technical stop. They are okay.
Okay, wow, that's great.
They clambered down again and found a patch of soft grass, the great train blotting out the landscape behind them and keeping the wind away, and they sat on a blanket Marek unfurled with some ceremony.
Wow, said Nina, smiling, a midnight picnic.
Solemnly, Marek opened up a wicker basket and brought out food Nina had never seen before, little meat dumplings and blintzes and pickles. She tried a few things, including the tart, fresh radishes. He also produced a tiny bottle of champagne with its own straw. Nina exclaimed,
I cannot drink on train, he said shyly, but I thought you might.
He popped it for her with great care, and she giggled over something so silly and so wonderful. He took a sip, too, and made a face, then insisted she try something else from the little boxes he had unpacked, and she thought it was all wonderful, and they chatted inconsequentially of this and that. After they'd eaten, they both fell silent, and Nina found herself focusing quite strongly on his large, well-worn hands, covered in dark hair, and thinking of the little notes, the poems, the overspilling wild flowers. He was suddenly so close, and she wondered what would happen if she simply reached out and took his hand. She glanced at Marek. He was looking at her with a dreamy, hopeful, dark-eyed gaze. He was attempting to appear casual, but clearly he wasn't feeling that way at all. He looked intense, and suddenly, overwhelmingly attractive. Nina let her hand stray a little, almost casually, towards his. And now his hand moved forward, and suddenly it was on hers, covering it completely, caressing and stroking it. She moved towards him, just inching, and he took her wrist and drew her steadily closer until she was practically on his lap. Then he turned her face towards his wide, soft mouth and huge dark eyes, and she found they were kissing. And suddenly Nina realized that what she had imagined and built up in her head was here, was actually happening. That was the last thing she thought of before his strong arms went round her, and she lost herself utterly, pressed up against him, his mouth on hers, the rest of the world simply melted away. Suddenly, shockingly out of the blue, a bright light shone over the top of the hill, and a Land Rover roared towards the level crossing. When it saw the gates were shut, it honked its horn, loudly in frustration. Nina and Marek leapt apart, both of them startled, breathing heavily. Nina stared towards the vehicle. The voice that came out of it was loud and familiar and cut across the quiet landscape.
"What the bloody hell is going on? Move this effing train!"
Marek leapt up and went to the barrier, where Lennox was standing in front of the Land Rover, looking typically furious.
"Sorry, we're doing technical. Move the sodding train!"
Nina joined Marek at the gate. Lennox gave a sigh of exasperation.
"Ugh, I might have known you'd be caught up in this. What the hell?"
"Why are you so cross?" said Nina boldly. "It's the middle of the night. Where'd you have to get to in such a hurry?"
It was then she saw that he was holding the lamb in his arms. There was blood on his jacket.
"What's wrong with him?" she said in horror.
"Stray dog," muttered Lennox. "Bastards. They must have let him off the leash. Should have shot the bloody thing."
"You'd shoot a dog?"
"If it worries my sheep, I will. Move the damn train."
Marek had already leapt up into the driver's seat and turned on the engine. He looked down at Nina desperately.
"Come with me," he said.
Nina stared back at him. Lennox was glaring at her. She felt completely torn. Marek's big dark eyes were pleading. Lennox was growling in impatience.
I can't," she said.
Marek blinked and nodded. They stared at each other for a long time.
"And I have to."
"I know,"
said Nina, not breaking his gaze. She could feel Lennox humming in frustration next to her as the train started, very slowly, to move. Suddenly, barely knowing what she was doing and completely surprised at herself, Nina made a run for the steps and jumped up onto the footplate of the engine, where she kissed a very surprised Marek firmly on the lips through the window, caressing his face. His mouth was soft and warm, and she wanted nothing more than to stay with him, but she knew she could not. And as he took his hand off the dead man's handle to slow the train down, she jumped lightly back down to the ground again. Lennox had gone back to the Land Rover, and was watching as the train steadily gathered speed, chugging faster and faster. When it was beyond the crossing, he looked at Nina contemptuously and opened the car door. Nina found herself running after him.
"I can't take you with me," he said crossly. "I'm off to Kyle's, remember?"
The lamb, she could see now, had a great tear in its flank and was whimpering.
"Oh," she said, "can I hold him? Poor little thing."
"No," said Lennox curtly. "Haven't you got a railway to get yourself killed on?"
"Why are you so mean all the time?"
"Because I'm trying to save an animal's life. So sorry if that interferes with your utterly ridiculous love life."
"There's just no need for that,"
said Nina, white hot with anger. You're my landlord, not a policeman.
Lennox fired up the Land Rover angrily. Whilst you're parking trains up willy-nilly and doing God knows what at all hours in public, I think I'm allowed an opinion.
The lights of the Land Rover lit up the remains of their picnic, the champagne bottle lying sadly on its side in the damp grass. They both stared at it. Lennox turned round one last time to look at Nina, who was shaking with fury and cold in the night air.
"Do you know anything about him?" he said. "Because I know men who travel far and work the longest, the hardest shifts, and it's always for their families."
And with a lurch, the Land Rover was gone, leaving Nina alone and furious in its wake. Nina watched the red lights disappearing into the distance. Hateful, bloody, horribly embittered old divorcee. How dare he? How the hell was it his business? And what the hell did he know? So she hadn't asked Marek much about his background, but it had been so lovely and delicious just falling into it, the whole romance of it. He never spoke about Latvia, so she never asked. It was that simple. She didn't want to think of it. That somewhere, on a cold and snowy plain, in a little village or a Soviet apartment block, there were people waiting for him. People relying on him. She was turning round to stomp back towards the village when the Land Rover returned and the door opened.
"So, I can't leave you here on your own in the dark. Although he apparently can."
"I'm fine."
"Yes, but you think climbing dying trees and dancing about on railway lines is also fine. So, excuse me if I'm not sure I trust your judgment."
Lennox drove her rapidly home in silence, then headed off again, still with the lamb in his jacket. She barely thanked him. Nina couldn't sleep. She was thinking back to the feel of Marek's mouth against hers. His beautiful, soft mouth, his big, solid hands. She knew there was a poet in there. She was sure of it. They couldn't communicate much, but she was sure she could feel him inside, couldn't she? Around 4 a.m, she saw the lights of the Land Rover scrape the roof and knew Lennox must be back, but that merely made her cross again. She heard a soft baaing as the car door opened, and a gentle murmuring, which annoyed her even more, seeing as he patently had it in him to be perfectly kind and sweet, as long as you had 4 fricking legs. She was still cross when she heard the chicken start squawking 2 hours later, as Lennox set off for work, and she realized she'd barely slept a wink. Her shoulders were up round her ears. She was so stressed, it was worse than being back in the city. She pulled herself out of bed and stood in the shower for ages, but it only made her long for bed more than ever. No, she had a job now. That was how it was. Only Sarinda was sleeping peacefully on the sofa as Nina wandered over to fiddle with the expensive coffee machine in the kitchen, then stomped crossly out to the van. The weather steadfastly refused to reflect her mood, and the sun beamed down in a most uncharacteristic fashion. Nina blinked and put her sunglasses on for practically the first time since she'd arrived.
Chapter 22. A book for the furious. Nina almost laughed when she saw it, because it was so precisely what she was looking for. An enormous tome of revenge stories, ranging from pouring molten silver into the eyes of a thief to launching a pirate fleet.
"I don't care," she thought. "I don't care about him." But she did want to see Marek again, to kiss him again under the moon. She sighed and glanced at her watch. Edwin and Hugh were crossing the cobbled square to sit and have a pint in the sunshine, and Nina waved to them. They waved back cheerily and asked her if she wanted to join them, and she didn't know how to explain to them that she couldn't drink because, A, she was driving a van, and, B, it was just past 8 o'clock in the morning. But she knew what they wanted, really, and dug it out. The newest labyrinthine saga from the subcontinent. Hugh had developed a real taste for them. It was a thank you, really, for everything they had done for her, helping her buy the van. Hugh would always insist on paying, and Nina would make sure there was no price written on it, and purse her lips and say, "I'm terribly sorry, Hugh, that one is £1.50.
and he would look pained, and she would offer to discount it even further, and he would gallantly refuse. So they got tremendously cheap books, and she got to say thank you, so everyone was happy. Ainsley was usually sidling up at this time. Even though Nina welcomed her wholeheartedly every single day, the girl still acted like she wasn't wanted, mooching towards the van, bent over as though trying to hide. But today, she was nowhere to be seen. There was, however, someone else. A grubby, cheeky figure dressed in a ragged T-shirt and shorts, displaying very scabbed knees. Ainsley's little brother.
Ben?
The child sniffed. There was snot crusted round his nose, as well as long lines on his dirty sweatshirt. He marched up to her defiantly.
Ainsley's no coming today.
Why not?
She's got... dunno.
Nina frowned.
Well, is it something to do with school?
Aye.
Has she got exams?
Ben shook his head.
No,
he said.
No. She's been told she can't take her exams. She's all sad and stuff. Exams sound rubbish.
Nina looked around. The market wasn't busy yet. In her bad mood, she'd got up far too early after her rough night. She yawned. There were just a few old men walking their dogs and some women sniffing the produce.
Why can't she take her exams? She said. That's awful. She's such a smart girl.
Ben shrugged his shoulders.
Dunno,
he said.
Nina blinked.
Okay,
she said finally, remembering Ainsley's horror when she'd tried to find out more about her home life.
Okay, thanks so much for coming to tell me.
Ben lingered. She could see he was peering inside, looking at the red and yellow bean bags. She waited a moment.
Would you like to come in?
No.
She paused.
Okay.
Ben still didn't seem keen to leave.
I think I'm going to sit out on this step, said Nina gently. Enjoy the sunshine, and maybe just read for a bit.
Ben sniffed.
Hmm,
he said. Nina was going to ask whether he had school that day, but she figured that was probably something he had heard quite a lot, so she didn't. Instead, she picked up a copy of Up on the Rooftops. They'd sold all but two of them, including one she'd kept behind for herself, and took it out to the step, remembering as she did so how reading this book as a child had made her feel utterly, and without a doubt, that if she only met the right magic pigeon, kept St. Paul's as her compass and didn't forget north for truth, west for fresh, south for source, but east, ever east, then everything would work out all right in the end.
East, ever east,
she said out loud, eyeing Ben carefully. He was affecting an unconcerned look, but still hadn't moved away. Hattie, a local woman she'd got to know with four children under five, and a look that occasionally said, kill me now, came bounding up.
"Oh, my God, you're here early,"
she said in delight.
"So are you,"
observed Nina.
"Are you joking? It's nearly 8:30. I've been up for 4 hours. As far as I'm concerned, it's lunchtime. Ewan, stop that. Leave that dog alone. Tildy,
In their buggy, the twins set up a cacophonous roar. Hattie didn't go anywhere without a halo of crumbs around her, and outside the van was no exception.
Are you doing story hour?
Hattie was constantly trying to persuade Nina to do a story session that involved her leaving all the children there, but Nina strenuously refused, muttering health and safety as a warding-off spell, to which Hattie had once sadly responded,
"Well, I don't mind if you lose one of them. I've got loads of others."
And then laughed it off a little too shrilly. Nina blinked.
"I'll do it if you like, but you have to stay." "Just one tiny spa break," said Hattie. "That's all I ask. Just one teensy-weensy 48-hour break in New York."
"I wish that was within my magical book powers," said Nina. "Actually, I can recommend some globe-trotting glitzbuster stuff if you like. Might help."
"Yes," said Hattie. "I'll read it in the 2 seconds a day I have spare. Normally just before they discover I've locked myself in the bathroom."
Nina sat back down and started reading aloud from Up on the Rooftops, and the twins quietened down immediately. Not because they could follow the story,
but because the soothing cadence of somebody reading always had a transformative effect on babies. Griffin's theory was that children were evolutionarily engineered to listen to stories because it stopped them wandering off into the woods and getting eaten by hairy mammoths. And as the three children in the story found themselves stranded on the top of their building after climbing the 1,000 steps, she couldn't help but notice scruffy little Ben edging closer and closer until he was sitting cross-legged right in front of her at the foot of the steps. At the end of the chapter, she closed the book to great sighs, particularly from Hattie.
"I love that book," she said. "Thank you. 10 minutes of peace and quiet. That is my record this decade."
Nina smiled. The children started clamoring for more.
"Oh, good," said Hattie. "The bakery's open. I'm going to go and get them all sticky. Then we can have a bath. Surely that'll take me up to 9:30. Just out of interest, and absolutely nothing to do with anything, what time do you open a bottle of wine of an evening, stroke afternoon, stroke lunchtime?"
"See you later," said Nina, smiling and tactfully prizing a set of very sticky fingers off the book.
"I'll take one," said Hattie.
There was only one copy left after this. Nina looked at Hattie.
"I need it," said Hattie.
"Okay," said Nina, rather regretfully selling it. She watched them all clattering noisily over the cobbles, somebody wailing.
"What happened, though?" said a little voice by her feet. "What happened next?"
Nina looked down. "Well, lots of things," she said. Ben pouted.
"I would like to know," he said. "Have they made it into a film?"
"Yes," said Nina, "but the film is terrible."
"Why is the film terrible?"
"It's not really the film's fault," said Nina. "But you know when you're watching a film, you feel like you can see what's happening?" Ben nodded. "Well, that's one thing, but when you read a book, you feel like you're in it."
"Like a computer game?"
"No, not like a computer game. Computer games are fun, but you're still just looking at stuff and pressing buttons. Reading is being in stuff." Ben squinted.
"Like actually being there?"
"Like actually being there. You plug straight into the writer's brain. It's just you and them. You experience what they experience." Ben looked at her for a while, then scuffed his trainer on the pavement. There was a long pause.
"That sounds no bad."
Nina figured she needed more coffee and poured some from her flask. Then she brought out, "We're going on a bear hunt," and looked at Ben.
"Want to have a look?"
Ben glanced all round the square to make sure nobody was looking at him and there weren't any other boys around. Then he shrugged.
"All right. Well, come and sit down here."
And the two of them sat on the steps in the morning sunshine and painfully, slowly, and with much grunting from Ben, made their way through it. Finally, they got up. Ben looked like he might almost say thank you.
"Where are you going now?"
Nina asked carefully.
"Are you going back home?"
Ben shrugged.
"Maybe."
Oh, Lord. Nina thought again that she really needed to call social services, or someone, but Ainsley had begged her so hard.
"You could go to school," she said,
as gently as she was able, feeling as if Ben was a timid animal that might bolt at her touch.
"You know, if you liked." "The other kids are mean," said Ben. "They call me dirty."
He was undeniably dirty. Nina sighed. She would slip a little more money to Ainsley, suggest she bought him a new shirt.
"You could wash in the coffee shop," she said. "They wouldn't mind, and just go to school. Ignore those other kids. Who cares about them?" "I hate it," said Ben. "It's just stupid people saying stupid things and telling you to eat vegetables and stuff."
"I know," said Nina. She watched the little figure pad across the square. He did go into the coffee shop, she noticed, and then the next of her customers arrived. Farmer McNab came in once a week and bought 4 space westerns. Fortunately, there'd been a lot of them in the boxes, because it was a narrow interest, that wasn't getting any new input any time soon. She'd tried to move him over to either real westerns or space opera, but he was having absolutely none of it. So now she'd emailed Griffin and was desperately trying to source anything online that had a picture on the cover of a cowboy wearing a space helmet. By the time she'd dealt with Mr. McNabb's queries about how one tamed a Martian horse, neutron rains, she'd lost sight of Ben. She worried all morning, serving a long line of people, many, she was pleased to see, absolute regulars.
"This is your fault," said Mrs. Gardner, brandishing a huge saga about a Native American woman who'd been magically sent back in time to the court of Henry VIII, who had promptly set about attempting to make her his seventh wife, with pulse-racing results.
"You've got me hooked on these book things."
"Good," said Nina, but she was still thinking about Ben when Sarinda turned up to whisk her off to lunch.
"The lucky thing about you," began Sarinda, watching Nina's eyelids droop as they sat in the little pub garden and ate Cullen skink, a fishy, creamy soup with which they'd both become horribly obsessed, accompanied by rough brown bread and locally smoked salmon, which tasted so different to the oily, rubbery stuff that Nina was used to on the rare occasion she could afford it from the supermarket, that it might as well have been a different food altogether. In the sunlight, with half a lager shandy in front of her, Nina felt her horrible mood start to lift a little.
"What's lucky about me?" she said, "because I don't feel very lucky."
"Well, you can just finish for the day now, can't you?" said Sarinda. "You've sold a bunch of stuff. You can go home and take a nap."
This hadn't occurred to Nina, who tended to work a full day from force of habit, not to mention being unable to shut the shop if there was even the slightest chance of another sale. After years of working in public service, it had come as a bit of a surprise to her how genuinely interested she was in running a business. Seeing what worked, looking at stock, and, of course, matching the right book to the right person. It was the same joy she had always felt at the library, but somehow, watching people leaving with books they could keep forever was even more profound.
"Oh, yeah," she said. "Well, can't you? You're making enough, aren't you?"
Frowning, Nina explained about Ainsley and Ben.
"Oh, God," said Sarinda. "You should just report it."
"But Ainsley begged me not to."
"Yes, but you don't know what's going on," said Sarinda. "It could be really, really awful at home. There could be some evil stepdad doing horrible things. She might have Stockholm syndrome or something. Kids are weird like that. They'll defend their family, even if it's completely messed up."
"Yeah," said Nina. "Yeah."
"So, last night?" said Sarinda, leaving it hanging.
"Oh," said Nina, dropping her head. "Oh, God."
And she told Sarinda everything.
"Oh," said Sarinda. "Well, Lennox might be right. I mean, why hasn't Marek invited you anywhere normal?"
"Lennox is a judgmental asshole."
"Or Marek sending all his money back to his family." Nina didn't reply.
"Oh, come on," said Sarinda. "What did you think would happen? Marek was going to take you boldly in his strong and manly arms."
Nina didn't want to answer that, either.
"What, he was going to lay you down and give you a doing on the floor of the cab?"
"You don't need to be so explicit."
"It's what you were thinking, though."
"It's been ages, ages."
Sarinda laughed and shook her head.
"Your fantasy life is out of control, man."
Nina felt herself going pink.
"I know. I mean, it's not real, is it?"
Nina thought back to his soft lips on hers, the surprise on his face.
"Yes," she said. "Yes, it is, and I just want some more romance in my life. Is that so wrong?"
Sarinda shrugged. "There's plenty of romance around here. Boys outnumber girls 5 to 1. There's a million blokes to choose from. Only you could get yourself hopelessly hooked on one who passes through at midnight and can't stop. It's not about Marek. It's about you." Nina felt her face make a defiant expression.
"Ha," said Sarinda. "You like to appear a pushover, but inside you're as tough as old boots."
"Everyone's different to how they look on the outside," said Nina.
"Not me," said Sarinda, and Nina was forced to concede that she might well be right.
"Listen," said Sarinda. The tone of her voice made Nina lift her head. She knew almost before Sarinda said it.
"Look,
I have to go. They're really going to fire me this time. They were meandering back from the pub, heading for the van. Nina suddenly felt overcome with exhaustion. She stopped suddenly in the road.
No, she said. Do you have to?
All I've done since I've been here is eat toast and give you a hard time, pointed out Sarinda, not inaccurately. I have to get back to work. Plus, watching how hard you work makes me feel guilty.
It's been great having you here. What about the Gus?
Sarinda let a smile play about her lips.
Well, she said, it's nice to know he's here, but also that I can do it, you know? It's just nice to attract men I actually like.
As they crested the hill in the van, the farm came into sight below them, its old stone walls golden in the light.
I'm really going to miss this place, said Sarinda.
You're so lucky, you know.
Do you think?
I do think, said Sarinda. I think you've found what you should be doing, where you should be doing it, and most people don't get that. They don't get anything like that.
But I'm lonely, said Nina.
You're making friends every day, said Sarinda. Don't rely on fantasy guys, okay? Meet real ones. There's no shortage. They watched Lennox striding across the fields not far from where they were passing.
You could even try getting it on with your hot landlord, said Sarinda.
He's not hot, said Nina. Let me see. 6'2", curly hair, long, lean body of the kind I totally know you like. Muscles, blue eyes, jaw like an action man. Sarinda was counting off on her fingers. Saves baby animals, strides about in a manly fashion, has a posh barn. No, absolutely nothing hot about that at all.
He's not hot because he's a dick, said Nina.
Well, so's that boy you fancied at school, Sarinda reminded her.
One, that was school, and two, he's in prison.
Pooh's my point. Back at the house, Nina watched Sarinda packing.
Are you... Is Marek giving you a lift down? She couldn't help asking eventually.
Take your nap, and no, because I, for one, know when to leave well alone. I'm flying out of Inverness.
Invernish, corrected Nina absent-mindedly.
A clutch of islanders had been passing through and had bought all her commercial fiction, and she'd picked up their pronunciation.
Do you need a lift?
There was a honk in the farmyard. It was the Gus. Sarinda ran outside and jumped up onto him, wrapping herself around his waist as he kissed her deeply. Nina sighed. She couldn't help it. That was what she wanted, just some lovely romance, someone happy to see her. Why couldn't it be Marek?
Don't go, the Gus was saying.
Come down to Birmingham, Sarinda said, throwing her bag in the back of his SUV.
Oh, I'm not sure. I don't do well in cities, said the Gus. They won't let me bring my dog.
Entire cities, said Sarinda.
Entire cities, and I can't walk there. Too many people in the way.
They kissed again as Nina went over to say goodbye.
Get her to come back, said the Gus,
his freckles more comically visible than ever after all the sunshine.
Soon. Forever.
I can't get her to do anything, said Nina, smiling. Excuse me, right back at you, said Sarinda, leaning out of the window. She touched Nina on the arm.
This is the place for you. Genuinely. I think you belong here.
So I'm never to darken your doors again, said Nina, grinning.
Oh, God, yes, you have to do that.
We're still not quite finished with all those bloody books.
Chapter 23 Summer holiday time meant masses of children's books and big fat summer novels, romances, but also a lot of serious fiction, as people carved out time for themselves to read books they'd been putting off for years. Nina found herself getting through a load of classics. As she toured the little towns, everyone came to tell her where they were going on holiday and what they were thinking of reading, and she passed on her recommendations and tips. She was asked so often if she was going to the Midsummer Festival that she almost considered it. She had also called social services about Ainsley and Ben, feeling quite horribly guilty as she did so, and they had sighed and said they would add them to the list, but they were quite backed up, so it wouldn't be straight away. Nina had tried to ask Ainsley about her exams in a roundabout way, and that sullen teenage mask had come clanging down,
and she hadn't been back to the van for 4 days. Nina hated the idea of her losing that, too, so she didn't say anything else, just snuck her as much money as she could spare. She had other things on her mind, too. More specifically, a little note left in a beautiful carved wooden box on a branch of the old tree that said simply, "Please come." She was torn. She didn't want to miss her regulars, miss her busy selling days. On the other hand, she wanted to visit her old home to see if she felt different or if it had changed at all, and to see Sarinda, obviously. Everyone in the village had been asking after her. She'd obviously made quite an impression. And the Gus was quite lovesick with sadness, and buying lots of books about lonely mavericks who lived lonely lives solving crimes on the road. Also, Griffin had tipped her off about some stock that was going up for auction in Birmingham, and she finally felt brave enough to do the long-haul journey in the van. But more than anything, she wanted to see Marek again. She wanted to see him so much. He was all she thought about. So she made herself go for it. She was going to tell Lennox she was leaving for a few days, but she hadn't seen him, so she reckoned there was absolutely no point, not that he'd give the smallest rat's arse. She did buy Parsley a bone, though, so he'd know she'd miss him. It was strange being back in the city. Nina realized she'd got used to everyone in the village recognizing her and knowing everything about her and her business. The speed with which it had happened had been both surprising and actually very touching. It was lovely being greeted by name at the post office or in the bank and being able to help out here and there. Sarinda, after flinging her arms around her, was frowning. "It's awful," she said. "It's sticky and too hot, and every patch of grass has horrible fat men lolling on their horrible fat arms, looking like they've dressed in toddler's clothes. 3/4-length trousers, sandals, hairy toes. It's gross. I miss Scotland so much. At least you can sleep at night." "It smells weird here," said Nina. "Did I really never notice before?" "No, I noticed it too," said Sarinda, "when I got back. It's bins and rotting food and unfresh air." Soon they were walking down the road. The tarmac was sticky and shimmered in the heat. The air was hot and still. People were sitting aimlessly on their front steps. The pub at the corner of the road was overflowing with outdoor drinkers, shouting and talking noisily. Everywhere was mobbed and hot and full. Nina frowned. "I've just lost the habit of so many people. There's too many people here." "Yeah, all right, all right," said Sarinda. "Could you get them to open a Kirin Thief branch of my business, please? I don't think I can commute that far." Nina smiled. "Yes, that's right. All we need up there is a great big city dumped right in the middle of it. You could move to Perth." Sarinda sighed. "I don't think so," she said. Her tone of voice changed. "I'm not brave like you, Nina. I couldn't toss my life up like you did. What about my mother?" "Encouraged by you," Nina pointed out. "Yes, but I didn't think you'd actually do it. I thought it was just leverage so I could get my hallway back." Griffin hailed them from across the horribly crowded bar, waving furiously. He looked strange without his beard, and was wearing a ridiculous T-shirt with a picture of a raccoon on it and a weird beanie hat. "Griffin?" He came up with 3 bottles of cider and hugged them both. "Oh, thank God, grown-ups, thank God. What's up with you?" Griffin held Nina at arm's length and looked at her. "What's up with you? You've changed." "No, I haven't," said Nina, "apart from being out of direct sunlight." Griffin shook his head. "No, it's not that. You look... you've got roses in your cheeks." "Does that mean fat?" "No, but you do look... sturdier." "Fuck off, Griffin." "That sounds wrong, but I don't mean it like that. You look... stronger. More substantial. Less wispy." "I'm not a photograph from Back to the Future." "Oh, I don't know what I'm saying. Ignore me. My head is being done in by my job. Take it from me. You look good. Better than good." And Nina could see in the way he looked at her that he meant it. "So do you," she said, even though he looked a bit daft.
He was obviously trying to fit in with his cool young team. He'd even had his ears pierced.
"How's work?"
Griffin made a face and took a huge swallow of his drink.
"Don't start," he said. "It is so lovely to see you. But if you start going on about how wonderful your life is now, and how you choose your own hours and have a lovely bookshop tootling around the country, I'm going to have to kill myself."
"Okay," said Nina. "It's awful."
"It isn't," said Griffin. "Sarinda told me all about it. She said it's awesome and gorgeous, and she's going back up next time she gets some holiday."
"Or I might just pull a sickie," said Sarinda. "Why don't you come up too?" said Nina.
Griffin shook his head. "No, I couldn't bear it if it's nice. I really couldn't. I have to go in every morning at 7 and start ploughing through all the human resources paperwork, then go to county meetings about development access, then come back and fix all the computers that have broken down because they break down every day. Then I have to show 90-year-olds how to use them because they've shut all the rural banks down so they can't do their banking. It's like an entire generation has been thrown into a world they don't understand and where nothing makes sense. And they've just been told, tough luck. Learn how to type or you can just starve to death."
He took another swig of his cider. "Do you remember how nice it used to be when the kids came in?"
"You hated it when the kids came in," said Nina, outraged. "They got sticky finger marks on all your Frank Millers."
"Yes, I said I hated it," said Griffin.
"You did. You hated it."
"Well, it was paradise compared to this. It was lovely. People coming in to share stories or books or things they liked. Now it's people coming in because they're desperate. They're cut off from the world because they don't have the internet. All their benefits have been taken away and they can't make ends meet. And nobody is left out there to care because they cut and they cut and they cut. I'm a librarian, and now I'm an IT support worker with a side order of psychology, addiction counselling and social work. Plus, I generally have a 19-year-old member of staff crying in the toilet because they're not feeling self-actualised enough."
Nina fell silent. She wasn't sure what to say.
"You should move there," said Sarinda.
"So should you," shot back Griffin. "We're not all as cool as Nina."
Nina wasn't in the least bit cool, but didn't feel up to pointing it out. They all moved outside the pub. Over the side wall, a fight was brewing, and a girl with very blonde extensions was hovering about, excited to be in the middle. A clutch of teenagers were boasting loudly and cheerily in the corner, not listening to one another, looking leery and anxious. People were pushing and shoving to get to the bar. Nina realized she was feeling stressed. Her heart rate was raised, and she was overwhelmed by the sheer amount of people around her, the smell of exhaust, the noise of honking cars and clinking glasses and noisy squeals, and all the general Friday night sense of a summer city weekend in full swing. She thought how the evening would end. Girls without shoes, lots of hollering in the street, ambulance sirens wailing, and wondered, rather traitorously, how soon Sarinda would want to go home. In the end, she didn't have to wait that long. Griffin got drunk and maudlin and looked like he was about to cry, and then suddenly a whole clutch of lovely young people, noisy and expectant and giggly, arrived, and it turned out one of them worked with Griffin and yelled his name. He immediately transformed and became bouncy and cheerful and started using phrases like "reverse ream" and "that's so basic." And Sarinda and Nina looked at each other, and by mutual agreement, sidled away. They walked home together slowly through the muggy evening, the dark settling around them.
"It's still light up at..."
Nina realized she'd been about to say home.
"Up north," she finished quickly.
They passed two cats having a fight on a wall as someone hollered at them from on high to shut the F up. From the next building came loud banging EDM. Someone was yelling at them to shut up, too. A car with its top down and music blaring out of it came squealing up the road far too fast. The girls both started. The occupants of the car laughed loudly, then started catcalling a hen party that was marching in the opposite direction. Sarinda sighed.
"So,
desperate to move back?
Nina shook her head.
I'm going to fill the van once and for all, and then that's it. I think I'm done here.